Today, agendas, agendas, the DFA Daily to the 20th of July, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. Firstly, a quick reminder that tomorrow, Tuesday, on the DFA Live, I'll be walking through the latest property and household confidence scenarios, taking account of all the available data before the Treasurer's statement on Thursday of the next phase of government support, which, by the way, will need to be both targeted and substantial. So mark your diary for my show, 8 p.m. Tuesday, Sydney time, tomorrow. Thursday is meant to be the big reveal day, when the government spells out the next phase of its support for the economy. All the talk of a bounce back is gone as reality, which, by the way, we predicted back in February, has played out, with virus hotspots crimping the recovery. I want to make the point that in the neoliberal world, profit is king, and the variable during recessions is higher unemployment, buttressed by minimal support for people on the dole queues and a constant push to get people back working again. Dole will be kept very low. Debt will be kept at a minimum, and a government surplus should be the target. Household debt, by the way, is seen as a positive as it stimulates growth and drives more profit to the owners of the economic machine. Oh, and it assumes perpetual growth, of course. The KPI is growth. The risk is inequality. The maxim is market efficiency. The new old kid on the block, MMT, says that full employment is the primary goal, and the variable to achieve this is government finance, given that if you can create your own currency, then you can create more money, and with interest rates so low, this hardly costs, given the growth which can be generated. And such finances can run like this for generations. So in fact, in this world, the key variable is public debt, which, by the way, should not be seen through the same lens as private household debt. The KPI is employment, the risk is too much debt and potentially inflation. The government will create jobs for all those who want them, so we might want to ask also if this is making work for the sake of work, and the maxim is full employment, never mind efficiency. Yet it also assumes continual growth. Now, put like that, neither formulation seems that attractive, frankly. And as a recent Harvard Business Review article pointed out, economic growth has raised living standards around the world. However, modern economics have lost sight of the fact that the standard metric of economic growth, gross domestic product, merely measures the size of a nation's economy and doesn't reflect a nation's welfare. Yet policymakers and economists often treat GDP, or GDP per capita, in some cases, as an all-encompassing unit to signify a nation's development, combining its economic prosperity and social well-being. As a result, policies that result in economic growth are seen to be beneficial for society. We know now that the story is not so simple, that focusing exclusively on GDP and economic gain to measure development ignores the negative effects of economic growth on society, such as climate change and income inequality. It's time, perhaps, to acknowledge the limitations of GDP and to expand our measures of development so that it takes into account a society's quality of life. For example, India is beginning to focus on the ease of living of its citizens. Ease of living is the next step in the development strategy of India, following the push towards ease of doing business that the country has achieved over the past few years. The Ministry of Housing and Urban Affairs has developed the Ease of Living Index to measure quality of life of its citizens across Indian cities, as well as economic ability and sustainability. It is as well expected to evolve into a measurement tool to be adopted across districts. And perhaps this more holistic measure will provide more accurate insights into the state of the development of the Indian economy. The end goal is to have a more just and equitable society that is economically thriving and offering citizens a meaningful quality of life. With a change in what we measure and perceive as a barometer of development, the question, of course, is, can we frame policies that will catch up with that? in an economy with well-being at its heart, economic growth will simply be another tool to guide it in the direction that the society chooses. In such an economy, the percentage points of GDP, which are rarely connected with the lives of average citizens, will cease to take the centre stage. The focus would instead shift towards more desirable and actual determinants of welfare. So what indeed might emanate from Thursday's announcements? Well, job seeker needs to remain above its pre-COVID levels. Modelling commissioned by the Australia Institute shows the impact on poverty that the coronavirus supplement has had and what will happen if it is removed completely at the end of September. It also looked at the impact on poverty if the supplement of $235 per week is replaced by an increase in the base rate of $75 a week. The introduction of the coronavirus supplement did an enormous amount to reduce poverty in Australia. With that single change, 425,000 people were lifted out of poverty. However, the supplement has a legislated end date of the 24th of September 2020. The recession brought on by the pandemic has already increased unemployment by 2% and is expected to increase further before the end of September. If the supplement is removed in September as legislated, this would result in more than 650,000 people pushed into poverty. If the supplement is instead replaced by an increase in the base rate of $75 a week, 505,000 people will be pushed into poverty. Increasing the base rate by $75 does improve the situation slightly, but not enough to stop 500,000 people from entering poverty. Of those being placed into poverty as a result of the removal of the coronavirus supplement at the end of September, 120,000 will be children aged between 0 and 14. And poverty in childhood can have crippling lifelong effects on the child's cognitive development, social, emotional and behavioural development, as well as a range of adverse health outcomes. They say that if the supplement is instead replaced by an increase in the base rate of $75 a week, about 90,000 children will be moved into poverty. The vast majority of those moved into poverty either rent or have a mortgage. Comparing the number of people who will be in poverty if the supplement is removed in September with the number of people who were in poverty before the pandemic, about 500,000 either have a mortgage, 242,000, or rent, 246,000, and most of the remaining own their own home outright or are in public housing. And they say if the supplement is removed, there is little doubt that for many Australians, it will become increasingly difficult for people to pay a mortgage or pay the rent. This will not only mean an increased likelihood in homelessness, but also increasing pressure on the banking system. Additionally, if hundreds of thousands of additional people fall into poverty all at the same time, there will be a potential increase in people being unable to pay rent. And this will have a knock-on effect to those who own residential investment properties. Investment property owners also face consequences as a result of the ending of the coronavirus supplement. Replacing the coronavirus supplement with a $75 increase in the base rate will not significantly decrease the number of renters and mortgagees going into poverty. 211,000 mortgagees and 165,000 renters will still face poverty, a smaller fall compared to no increase, but still a significant impact on the lives of hundreds of thousands of Australians. Now, today's announcement to extend loans to businesses will hardly assist at all. Small employers will be given greater access to the $40 billion loan scheme to help them through the recession when the federal government overhauls its flagship JobKeeper payment this week. The expanded loan scheme will offer companies four times the amounts previously allowed, up to a new cap of $1 million, while extending repayment times from 3 to 5 years. And the existing scheme, which offered up to $40 billion of loan guarantees, only led to $1.5 billion of loans being made in the original scheme. The major banks are backing the easier rules for securing the loans and appear willing to lend to the thousands more companies, with their risks reduced because half the loan value would be guaranteed by the Commonwealth. The expanded scheme will allow businesses to access more credit for a longer period of time, Mr. Frydenberg said in a statement. Australian Bankers Association Chief Anna Bly said the changes would open up the scheme to more small and medium businesses needing help. But as the Bank Doctor wrote today, there are two very simple reasons why the scheme has not worked to date, and these same reasons explain why it is unlikely to work any better in the future. Firstly, SMEs are reluctant to borrow more when they don't know when this pandemic will end, and no one knows when this will be, especially, of course, if you live in Victoria. If they are reluctant to borrow up to $250,000 for up to 3 years, why would they be more inclined to borrow up to $1 million for 5 years, despite the fact that the scope of the scheme has been expanded somewhat? And it doesn't matter whether the purpose is working capital or for a long-term investment. Until they can see a future, they will remain reluctant to borrow. Secondly, banks are not going to provide unsecured debt to small businesses that may not survive. If they don't want to lend up to $250,000 unsecured for up to 3 years, why would they want to lend more money for a longer period? For most SMEs, more debt at this time is just not the solution, and expecting banks to provide more unsecured debt to businesses that may not survive is not in anyone's interests. Offering a guarantee for half the loans written has not induced banks to take more risks or lend more than they would have otherwise done so. And what about the rental time bomb then? Well, as reported in The Guardian, we really don't know how many renters have deferred rents due to be paid. The only exception was Queensland's Real Estate Institute, which has surveyed its 1,200 agencies with property management business and found that only 6.05% of residential rental tenants had qualified as COVID-19 impacted under the state government's COVID-19 Emergency Response Regulation. However, property managers had negotiated an additional 14% of temporary rent reduction requests beyond the regulation, representing more than 10,800 residential tenancies. The bulk of these temporary rent reduction reviews took place across Brisbane at 37.2%, the Gold Coast at 14.88%, the Sunshine Coast at 12.09%, and Cairns at 6.51%, with the majority of tenants requiring a rent reduction of up to $100 a week, around 69.3%. The survey did not say whether these temporary reductions were done as a deferral and repayable or as rent relief. All states have implemented moratoriums on evictions until late September, and some have schemes to help landlords and tenants negotiate rental reductions for people whose income is affected by the COVID-19 slowdowns. Some states, like Victoria, have offered grants of $2,000 to renters to help them. But there is anecdotal evidence that some renters are finding that they thought they had negotiated the cut, only to find that the landlord had offered a deferral. Bureaucrats, agents and even tenant advocates say no one knows how many renters are running up debts under COVID-19 regulations. So renters are facing a financial time bomb in September when state protections against eviction are due to expire, and many could be asked to repay deferred rent or begin paying their full rent again. But no one has a clear idea how big the problem might be or what effect it could have on the economy and the property market. Labour asked several bureaucrats at a Senate hearing into homelessness last week about the extent of rental debt. But neither the head of Social Security, Shane Bennett, nor the Bureau of Statistics could cast any light on what proportion of renters were accruing a liability, how many were behind in their rent, and how many had managed to negotiate a cut. We don't know how many people are behind in their rent and whether, when the eviction freeze ends, we're going to have a lot of people with a massive debt that they can't repay, Labour spokesman on housing Jason Clare said. The National Cabinet needs to find out quickly how many people are in this situation and work out what, if anything, needs to be done. The so-called rent bomb will come at the same time as likely changes to JobKeeper and JobSeeker support, although the government appears to be keen to avoid a financial cliff by ending the support too abruptly in September. The Treasurer, of course, will outline those further support measures on the 23rd of July. And to add to this, Sydney's loss-making landlords face more pain, with the city's rental vacancy rate soaring to a 20-year high, according to the Real Estate Institute of New South Wales. Sydney's in a ring experienced the most significant change, rising 0.8% to 5.8%. The CEO, Tim McKibben, said, last month, vacancies in the inner ring hit an 18-year high at 5.1%, a result that has been exceeded this month. And looking back at more than 20 years of survey results, we've not seen vacancy rates this high. It really is staggering. The impact of COVID-19 on the residential rental market continues to be significant and shows no sign of abating. And as unemployment continues to rise, and with the end date for JobKeeper and JobSeeker benefits looming, affordability is at the forefront of many tenants' minds. It's really no surprise that inner-city properties with higher weekly rents have been relinquished in favour of more affordable options. For Sydney's inner ring, if this trend continues, as is likely to for the foreseeable future, we can expect to see downward pressure on rents. While this is great news for tenants, it's a recipe for disaster for many landlords, he said. We assume JobKeeper will continue if in a targeted, tapered formulation. But what of property? Well, Cameron Cusher at REA wrote, time and time again, we have seen governments of all political leanings turn to housing stimulus in economic downturns. Here's why it stacks up, he says. The total value of housing assets in this country is $13.5 trillion, according to the statistics from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Of this $13.5 trillion, more than half at $6.9 trillion is made up of residential land and dwellings. To put that into context, the other large components were superannuation at $3 trillion, or 22.1%, currency and deposits at $1.2 trillion, or 8.8%, and shares and other equity at $1 trillion, or 7.6%. So with half our wealth tied up in it, it's no surprise this country is obsessed with property, he says. Then consider that until recently you couldn't touch a superannuation until retirement, and you are still limited as to how much you can withdraw, which is $10,000 last financial year and up to $10,000 this financial year. So of the wealth that you have free access to, it's housing and housing equity that's overwhelmingly the largest. Of course, a lot of the wealth in residential land and dwellings does have liabilities debt associated with them. The ABS doesn't publish residential land and dwelling liabilities, but separate data from the Reserve Bank shows that at the end of March, there was $1.8 trillion in owner-occupied and investor housing debt. Although this figure may not be exactly comparable, it is a good proxy and suggests that the value of the debt against the total value of residential land and dwellings is approximately 26.6%. Housing is the largest source of household wealth and is also the largest source of debt, while at the same time the property sector is one of the largest sectors of employment in the country. There is a wide range of research showing that there is a multiplier effect for every dollar spent on housing, leading to additional spending throughout the economy. While it may seem unfair that in periods of economic downturn, stimulus for the housing and construction sectors is prioritised over other sectors of the economy, when you break the numbers out like this, you can see why. Given the majority of household wealth is stored in housing, if you can stimulate this sector and stop price falls or encourage price increases, people will feel wealthier and in turn are likely to go and spend elsewhere in the economy, stimulating economic growth. Lenders have overwhelmingly prioritised lending for housing above business lending, so stimulus for the housing sector also helps lenders avoid financial losses and allows them to go about their business of lending. Keep in mind something which isn't necessarily captured in data but rings true is that many small businesses are funded via the home that the business owner owns, so supporting property prices also provides support for small businesses. None of this is to say that stimulus for housing is the way it should be, nor does it mean that every economic downturn will result in housing market stimulus. What it does indicate is that in times of economic trouble, stimulus for the housing sector is likely to be one of the first options that governments look to keep the economy growing, lenders, lending, and businesses open. And sure enough, some of the first initiatives out of the door on the back of COVID-19 have included the moratorium on rental evictions to assist both landlords and renters, moving official interest rates to historic low levels, and the home builder stimulus package for the housing construction sector. In previous economic downturns, we've also seen additional grants for first home buyers and rapid cuts to interest rates. With housing both the biggest source of our wealth and debt, the rush to both protect and stimulate makes sense in the current climate. Of course, property prices do still fall and could potentially incur large falls in the future, but it does mean policymakers, for better or worse, are likely to take reasonable steps to ensure it doesn't. Why? Because in a country both obsessed with and financially tied to property, the flow-on effects to the broader economy from large property price falls has the potential to be severe. And there you have, in a nutshell, the problem. We are overexposed to property to the point where it's too big to fail. And yet there are limits to how much property prices can be propped up when unemployment is so high. And frankly, JobKeeper, JobSeeker and the other initiatives that the government is likely to announce on Thursday may have some impact on the property sector, but we wonder whether they are running out of ideas. We'll see. Now, the economic impacts on the banks continue to amount. As Banking Day reported, extended loan repayment deferrals could cost the big banks anywhere from $700 million to $1.1 billion in lost revenue. Macquarie Securities said the extension of loan repayment deferrals for another 4 months, along with the extension of APRA's regulatory concessions, give the banks extra time to deal with issues, including the opportunity to restructure loans, and more customers are likely to be able to return to employment. Banks have more opportunity to resolve issues without putting customers into default, which would otherwise result in a sizable rise in risk-weighted asset density and hence capital intensity. Despite the positive aspects of the extension, Macquarie expects the increase in arrears to be meaningful as customers come off deferrals. Should the major banks offer ongoing deferrals to 25% of the customers currently in deferrals, this will translate to $350 million for ANZ, $549 million for Commonwealth Bank, $501 million for NAB, and $493 million for Westpac. If the banks offered ongoing forbearance to half their current deferrals, the revenue impact would be $740 million for ANZ, $1.1 billion for CBA, $1 billion for NAB, and $986 million for Westpac. And if the banks offer a significant number of customers with the option of restructuring their loans, such as switching to interest-only payments for a period of time or cutting the interest rate, the impact on revenue would be less, but it would be more prolonged. And finally, superannuation withdrawals continue to run, with the total set to surpass the initial $27 billion estimate the Treasury had made for how much would be withdrawn, as indicated by the accumulated applications out from APRA today. Will they extend this program, given that it's unclear how much of the withdrawal of funds are going to meet the original goals? Over the period, they say, from the inception of the scheme on the 20th of April to the 12th of July, payments made to eligible members have taken on average 3.2 business days from receipt of the ATO advice, and 96.2% have been made within 5 business days. And over the week to the 12th of July, 581,000 applications were received by funds, of which 109,000 were initial applications and 472,000 were repeat applications. This brought the total number of initial applications to 2.8 million and repeat applications to 0.8 million since the inception of the scheme. And over the week to the 12th of July, superannuation funds made payments to 734,000 members, bringing the total number of payments by funds to their members to approximately 3.3 million since inception. The total value of payments during the week was $6.2 billion, with $25.3 billion paid since inception. And the average payment made over the period since inception is $7,718 overall and $8,755 when considering repeat applications only. And as at the 12th of July 2020, 90% of applications received since inception have been paid. And this is up from the previous week at 83%, but down from the fortnight earlier at 95%. And as funds continue to process the large number of new applications received at the start of the financial year. but this is up from the previous week at 83%, but down from the fortnight earlier at 95%, as funds continue to process the large number of new applications received at the start of the year. Of course, we should be looking to more fundamental tax reform, a focus on tax leakage from the corporate sector. Even if the consumer tax cuts are brought forward, this will not help those not employed and will benefit the more affluent. We suspect the package on Thursday will frankly be a dog's breakfast with no real reform at all. As I said earlier, in an economy with well-being at its heart, economic growth will simply be another tool to guide it in the direction that the society chooses. If only, I think we're going to see more of the same old, no real strategic thought, and considerable amounts of reactive policy. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.